Hello, this is Mark Knights, and today I'm going to be talking about the growth of the fiscal military state in the 18th century. And this is part of a move, I suppose, away from what we've been looking at so far, which has been the focus very much on British domestic affairs, to Britain as an imperial and colonial power, and hence how that wider remit impacted on British identity and on the British domestic situation. So we've been seeing how, according to Linda Colley, war was instrumental in the process of forging a British identity. And therefore we need to think about how war, both in Europe and further afield, impacted on the British state. And I suppose we might think of this in two ways, because the state can be conceptualized in very different ways. We could take a very sort of top-down approach to it and think of the state as a set of institutions governing a particular territory with the capacity to make law regulating the conduct of the people within the territory, supported by revenue from taxation and reliant on a monopoly of legitimate force. That might be one very cogent definition. But more recently, historians, particularly of the period before 1689, have stressed that the English state was one which owed considerable loyalty, really, to the idea of a self-governing, participatory, dispersed sort of state, a sort of bottom-up state, if you like. So the questions that this set of historians have been asking, and I think with Mike Braddock at their fore, is where are those central institutions actually located? Who runs them? And if you start to ask those questions, the state looks rather different. Authority is dispersed into the localities because it's there that the voluntary office holders, the Lord Lieutenants, Sheriffs, JPs, Constables, and so on, are located. And therefore, what we tend to have is a state which is dependent on those self-governing communities, dependent on consent, if you like, to legitimize its actions. So we've got two models of a state. One is of a very centralized model, and the other is a very decentralized and indeed questioning the whole dichotomy between center and locality. So how do our discussions about military affairs fit into that? Well, even prior to the period that we're looking at, England had been moving towards some sort of resolution of its fiscal problems when faced with military threats. But this had been a problem which had been bedeviling, really, the English state throughout the 16th and early 17th century. And it was really only solved in the 1640s during the Civil War, when there were attempts to create new forms of revenue for the state to pay for armed conflict. And it's in that mid-17th century that we see perhaps the initial structures of a fiscal military state, in other words, a state capable of funding and fighting large-scale warfare. That pace, however, of change towards a fiscal military state accelerated enormously after 1689 because of the frequency of war and because of the scale of warfare. And the accompanying PowerPoint lists the wars that were fought and illustrates some of the extent of them. These wars were on a totally new scale. They're global wars, and therefore the imperial nature of warfare is adding an extra logistical burden. The effect of all that is an enormous expansion in the army and navy, in terms of their numbers and in terms of their cost. The effects of that are quite dramatic. Armed forces begin to intrude into civilian life. Soldiers become part of everyday life, if you like, in 18th century Britain. They increasingly find their way into the House of Commons. They increasingly offer a route for promotion and advancement, and troops could increasingly be used as a sort of domestic police force during riots. But it's not just a domestic army that is important, because the British Army is always and increasingly dependent on foreign manpower, and an awful lot of money is spent, again as the accompanying PowerPoint gives you facts and figures, on buying in military might from abroad to fight Britain's wars, all of which makes war an extremely expensive enterprise. Over 60% of governmental income in the late 17th century, for example, was spent on war. And this meant that there had to be new ways of financing such enormous amounts of money. And the British state cracks the difficult problem of how to extract taxation at a faster rate than economic or population growth. The Treasury therefore becomes more and more powerful during this period, imposing new taxes and higher levels of existing taxes. And in particular, sources of revenue from customs and excise taxes become ever more important. There is also a growing bureaucracy as a result of the increase in taxation. You need more people to try and collect the growing amounts of tax revenue. So the state also grows a bureaucracy, replacing or at least supplementing some of those voluntary office holders with paid governmental officials. And the PowerPoint has a number of facts and figures about the growth of the fiscal bureaucracy, as we might call it. These events are also accompanied by a financial revolution, a revolution in the City of London, which is creating new institutions which are designed to generate money for the state or at the disposal of the state. So semi-private, semi-public institutions like the Bank of England, like state-sponsored joint stock companies such as the East India Company, which make money available to the government. It also includes lotteries, very familiar from modern times, but lotteries were also a fiscal innovation designed to help out with the war effort. Now, you can see all that growth towards a fiscal military state in two very different ways. One, you can see it as enabling Britain to bring down the tyranny of Napoleon and the power of France, and you can see it as enabling Britain's conquest and rise and creation of an empire. However, it was also viewed with a good deal of suspicion in a number of ways. Firstly, the developments in the city led to a fear of speculation, its effects on morality, a fear of stock jobbers and people manipulating the stock market simply for their own ends. And there was also considerable hostility to taxation, leading to riots and public protest in 1725 and 1733, and again to considerable protest in the late 18th century when taxes were again hiked during the French Wars. And all this leads to a fear that the English liberties and the consensual dispersed state was being undermined and even destroyed, and that this new fiscal military state was overriding British liberty. And there's a number of illustrations of contemporary images and graphic satires to show how powerful the idea that John Bull was being ground down by the taxation that was being posed on him, and how the Treasury was gobbling up the constitution and the privileges and freedoms of the English people, and also pointing out that there was some opposition to war. War wasn't enthusiastically received uniformly in the 18th century, and particularly in the 1790s, there was a good deal of opposition to the war because of the consequences of war. So we end with a rather complex picture, if you like. On the one hand, a process of fiscal military state formation, and on the other hand, some serious reservations expressed about that process and about the effects of that process on society and on governance.